Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, welcome back to the Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson, eighth wonder of the world. I was a king and a god in the world I knew, but now look at me. Whew. Got a good one today. A return engagement from a man I consider one of the greatest film historians living, Mr. Rudy Belmer. I've interviewed Rudy once before for the Commentary Track, as I'm sure that my faithful listeners know. And this came about because after I had interviewed him the first time, which was really early on in the process, he was only the second or third guest on the Commentary Track, he called me up and said that there were a couple of things that he didn't feel quite right about, or things that he had started to say and didn't finish saying, or just wanted to make sure that he had clarified a couple of things, second-guessing what he had said, as we all do, and asked if I could come back and we could record a couple of inserts. Well, I was happy to do so. Went back over to his house, sat down at the same kitchen table, and recorded those two inserts, and before you knew it, another couple of hours had passed, and we had just kept talking. I was delighted to do that. I can think of nothing more fun than talking with Rudy Belmer, and every time I do, it's fun, it's informative, it's everything. I just have a great time with him, and man, oh man, he knows more about film history than anybody you're ever going to meet. And so it's great to sit down and talk with somebody who knows all and sees all. So I hope you will enjoy part two. Actually, it's not part two. It's a separate interview, but I hope you'll enjoy the second interview with the great Rudy Belmer. I want to talk to you a little bit about some of your books. The Inside Warner Brothers book is a real treasure. And give me a little bit of background on how you came up with that idea. And I can guess how you researched it, but...
really?
Yeah.
Well, very relatively briefly, I had always been a big Warner Brothers buff. You know, not that I didn't like movies from the other studios, but somehow the Warner Brothers, growing up in the 30s, you know, and then the early 40s, and there was something about that worked for me. Not only the people, but the kinds of material they did, you know, and they ripped from the headlines and so forth. So I was always a big fan of the Warner films. But then when I had that opportunity, which I believe we discussed before, about getting into the Selznick files, which was, you know, much earlier than the Warner Brothers thing in terms of researching, it was like a gold mine because, as we've discussed, you know, primary source material. This was written at the time it was happening and blah, 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 blah. So, you know, the fact that all of that was saved, or at least a large percentage of it. But I thought after the Selznick book, which came out in 1972, which, speaking of decades ago, I thought, well, that's that. You know, it's unlikely I'll find anything else like this. And then, of course, several years later, I heard that there was this stuff over at Warner Brothers. And I think I mentioned about going over there, you know, and the fellow was saying, yes, let me take it out, and showing me this. Well, this was before it went to USC. And I just thought, when I looked at that first box on Casablanca, I believe it was, or Robin Hood, one of the two, and I thought, what is this stuff at the top of all? I thought I was going to see all the script drafts. And here it was, you know, memos. And anyway, it was such a treat to think that, gee, the Selznick thing wasn't a lone wolf, you know. And anyway, to cut to the chase, or relatively speaking, then the next thing I heard was that the thing was going down, the material was being processed and going down to USC as a gift, within reason, from Warner Brothers. Of course, they could still access and, you know, so forth and so on. But I think I was there, the first one, in, you know, to go up to the library, the Doheny Library, where you would go at that time, on campus at USC, and start looking at the stuff. Now, originally, I was looking at the stuff because of a book I did called America's Favorite Movies.
Yes.
Which was a story of, you know, the making of 15 famous films, favorite films more. I guess they're famous and favorite. And so I was looking at Casablanca, The Adventures of Robin Hood, The Maltese Falcon, and Streetcar Named Desire, because those were four Warner Brothers films that were in there. So I was concentrating on that, and, you know, it was, the richness was beyond belief. And, of course, as opposed to the Selznick book, which was one man, which is fine, he was running the show, here's everybody. You know, you not only have Jack Warner, and you have Hal Wallace, who was the executive producer for so many years, you've got unit managers, you've got the directors, you've got the actors on occasion, you've got publicity, legal. So whatever it is, you know, you had this full spectrum of a studio during the studio system years, which of course was something that had great appeal for me, because, you know, you had all these people under contract, you had all these people who reported every day, and it was almost a city within the city. And I was always fascinated by that. Not that even after the changes, it was still fascinating, but somehow that studio period, particularly in the 30s and the 40s, up to the early 50s when things began to be modified. And here was all this stuff. So, you know, I got all that, and then I was thinking, I, on occasion, am apt to do, thinking, you know, maybe there's a book like the Selznick book on the Warner, I mean, I knew there was, but it didn't occur to me that maybe that would be, I'll broaden my scope here. And I thought, this might be something to explore. Anyway, I was granted an interview with the head of the legal department. We didn't go into this list,
no.
Did we?
No.
You know, it's hard sometimes to remember. You can cut that out.
Don't worry.
Yeah. Anyway, through the gentleman who was the head of the library at that time, the cinema library, I was granted an interview with the head of the legal department at Warner Brothers at the time, Peter Kinect. Yeah, was his name. And fortunately, he was an older guy, and he was getting ready, and I think 2 years later, or whatever, he was going to retire. But he had a frame of reference. It wasn't like he was the new kid on the block. And he also had read Memo from David O. Selznick. And so when I went in with my proposal, you know, and I wasn't asking for money. I was just saying, you know, could we make a deal of some kind where at least, you know, in the future, but I will have access to the material and would be able to shop it for publication. Of course, they would retain, Warner Brothers would retain the copyright, quite obviously. And there was no question about that. That's what happened with the Selznick book. But, you know, you have a percentage of, with your letter of agreement, you have a percentage of the fees and the royalties and the advance and all of that. That's all worked out in advance. But it's your show in terms of you have to go out and do the work, and you have to get the publisher. But at least, you know, it's a deal of sorts. Anyway, so then I went back, and I'm spending 2.5, 3 years, whatever it was, going through everything, you know. And by then, Leith Adams, you know, was the man down there. Of course, I'm constantly asking for, and I'm going down there, which you could at that time on Saturdays, because it was a day off from my job and everything. And they weren't open on Sunday, unfortunately. And so
they were now.
Yes, and so I'm doing all this stuff. And anyway, it was a great treat to go back to see what was happening at the time it was happening once again, which is very important to me. I'm certainly not against oral histories and interviews because, you know, there's a lot you can get from those, but you can't always, as we discussed before, rely 100% on what that person is saying.
Sure.
Anyway, but it's great to do that. I mean, that's, you know. So I do like to kind of do a little bit of everything. You'll go back into the files once again, you know, and the magazine articles of the time and this, that, and the other thing. But it was great to see this stuff and also to have the Breen office, you know, their response to some of the problems that they thought were problems at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And even though those files, the motion picture files, went to the Academy, they weren't there, I don't believe, at the time I was doing those books, those two books, the Selznick and the, if they were, you know, they cross-lapped or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it was great. So you got all that, too. So you had the censorship stories as well as the how they handled it and what they had to cut out and what they had to revise and so forth. Because that was a strong, strong number at that time. It wasn't something you kind of laughed at and thought, oh, don't worry about it. We'll fix it, baby sweetheart. No, that was not how you did it. You fixed it or you ran into a major problem. Anyway, so it was great, and I was so happy, and I just was wallowing in Warner Brothers, so to speak. And then that ended, and fortunately Viking Press, the same ones that did the Selznick book, agreed to, the team was still the same, so it wasn't like I was dealing with new people. And the general editor and so forth was still there. So that was the first thing they said when I wrote about it. They said, well, what about Warner Brothers? And I said, no, I have a letter of agreement. And I said, they have the copyright? Yeah, so that was the first question, naturally, they asked.
Sure.
How can we can't reproduce, you know. I said, yes, you can. Yes, you can. And I had to deal, I didn't have to, but it was, yes, I did have to, but it wasn't a big deal. I dealt with the line lawyer who had to go through the final manuscript and see things that, you know, would be a problem. And, you know, I knew that there were certain things that probably, whenever somebody wrote from the outside who was not an employee of the studio or a contract person or what have you, that could be a problem, because the philosophy was that this is business records, which what it was, and therefore we can use it. If it pertained to the business of the studio and the creative process and the production. But if somebody was writing from the outside, you have to get permission. Well, you know, trying to get permission.
Sure.
In those days. So anyway, there were a couple of those things, which I thought, you know, this might be marginal, that were cut. Then there were a few things that were within the text. There wasn't anything bad, but it would be like a personal something. So you do an ellipsis. They granted that. They said, oh, instead of losing the whole letter or the memo, do, you know, dot, dot, dot. So, but it's not like you were, oh, this is, you know, we're getting something revealing. But it would be something that was not in sync with the business records or the production record or something. And they didn't want to get into that. And I understand why. So it was approved by the legal department, which, of course, is very important. You can't do it without. So it was ready, and that was it.
I would think that the biggest problem I would have in such a thing is whittling it down, because it's such a mountain of material, and how in the world do you figure out what to put into a single book?
Well, I'll tell you, and once again, you know, everybody would do something a little different with it. There were the things that I thought were important, and the films that I thought were important, and the personalities, both in front of and behind the camera. And again, you can say, well, that's subjective, you know, so you like that film and that person and that. But, you know, there obviously that gave a lot of weight to Casablanca, because it's a hardy perennial, you know, decades and decades and decades, and it's still, you know, way, way up there. So naturally, I explored that, you know, almost from the beginning when they got the play until, you know, later on when it was finally released. And I gave more, as I did with Gone with the Wind in the Selznick book, you know, there's 100 pages there about that. Well, there's 50 pages. It was half as long on Casablanca. And, you know, obviously the pictures that we even had a lot of problems, you know, like some of the biographical films where they run into problems. I thought that would be of interest. And naturally the swashbucklers, the Robin Hoods and so forth. But anyway, you know, it was a call. Plus the fact that a lot of material, as you well know, Frank, it's not that, you know, there's a lot of routine things that wouldn't be of great interest unless that particular film you wanted to get everything. Okay. Well, this, it was a broad canvas. I mean, we are talking about basically from 1931 to 1951, although there's not that much from the 31 to 3, but starting around 34, 5, you know, then you're getting much more material because it was saved.
Yeah.
It was another a group of people, etc. Anyway, so to me, it wasn't that big of a challenge in terms of what do I want to, you know, you keep going through things and something would pop out and stand out in bas relief, and I had the permission to Xerox that, and it would be right there, so that I had that particular communication from the files. And the only things that I would Xerox would be things that were strong potentials, versus, well, I'm just going to Xerox everything, you know, which I couldn't do anyway. But right. So I kind of had that. It would be very, very obvious that this was of more than routine interest, if you're interested in the subject. Okay. Now, again, you think, well, you know, a lot of people, they'd say, who cares? Well, they wouldn't be reading the book.
Sure.
Or if they were, they'd stop after the first 20 pages, right?
Yeah.
Or they'd skip down to Casablanca or Streetcar Named Desire, you know, or what have
you. Well, it is a book that you can read that way. I mean, if you're...
Sure, you can pick out, that's one of my favorites. The Maltese Falcon, let's go to that. You know, let's go to Treasure Sierra Madre
exactly.
with all those great letters from B. Traven.
Oh, man.
I mean, to me, here's something that we hadn't seen before. And
absolutely.
B. Traven to John Huston, and John Huston to B. Traven, the mysterious
yes,
B. Traven.
Yes, very mysterious.
Let's not forget.
Who was he? What happened to him? Where did he go?
Quo Vadis.
We don't know. I remember when I did a book called Lost Films about, 15 years ago I guess. And I tried to be as explicit as possible in the foreword saying, okay, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of lost films. These are just the ones that I am interested in. This is a very subjective list.
Sure.
Yeah, I can't cover them all. This is just what I think is interesting to me. And so, of course, every review that came out, I didn't know why you didn't talk about it.
we've all been there, right? And, of course, the things you remember are the slams.
Yes, absolutely.
Or the mistakes that somehow were found after publication. And, you know, I'm not making it stupid, but we all make mistakes, you know.
Well, speak for yourself.
Excuse me, with the exception of you, Frank. But seriously, you know, no matter how much double-checking and careful, blah, blah, there's always going to be something, right?
No.
And, of course, in some cases, there's too much. We won't talk about that, will we? But, you know, no matter what you do, but, of course, there's always somebody who's going to say, and... If you go to page 86, and of course that's what you remember, right? You remember the negative.
Yes, I when I'm proofreading one of my books, I'll go through it with the proverbial fine tooth comb and just read and look and scour it, and then the day the published book arrives in the mail, this has never failed. I'll open it at random, and there's a huge mistake right there. That's the first thing I see.
And it stands out in what they call bas-relief.
Bas-relief, yes. Really. That's because you say bas
and of course,
when you see
and
it.
It's you know, it's inevitable, but it's not something that you look back on fondly.
Well, what I like about the Warner Brothers book in specific relation to you is because it seems like a book like I would have done, because I come at these things from my own personal interest.
Sure.
And it was actually kind of an epiphany one day when I realized I'm really interested in this subject. Hey, I could write a book about that.
You know, because,
and, you know, instead of writing a book about, say, James Dean or Marilyn Monroe things that actually might make me some money, God forbid.
Yes.
I just think, well, I'm really interested in this. And so the Warner Brothers, I know how far back you go with that and how important things like Robin Hood were to you. And so it's very much, I can understand exactly how that book was born.
It was the Colorado Lode.
Yes, it really was.
Well, and you know, it sounds so silly because we all have our different interests and so forth, but something like that primary source material from that period, and you know, that to me was just, I couldn't believe, you know.
I never get tired of looking through that stuff. The Paramount collection of the Academy Library.
Yeah.
Just, there are things that I've found in there that will never be suitable for anything I ever write, and yet I'm totally fascinated by it. For instance, going through the 39 Beaugest, files, they have all of the teletype messages from the set to the studio. And just, you know,
on the set, you mean on location?
Yeah,
which is great with
Yuma.
Location stuff when you get all this.
And so, you know, they had a movie theater on the at Camp Wellman to entertain the troops.
Yeah.
So they would. So I know what they showed. They showed Ecstasy with Hedy Lamarr. They showed they showed The Public Enemy because I guess Wellman wanted to show them one of his good ones. And
And Ecstasy had a
nuke
very
scene,
good
so,
turnout.
Yeah, it really did. So that, I don't know why that reminds me, completely tangential. I was good friends with Charlie Barton, who was, as you know, directed
yes.
many Abbott and Costello films,
yeah.
and he was in Beaugest as he plays Buddy. He and Broderick Crawford are the two.
I'd forgotten that.
And
I'm not sure I ever knew it, but I, but you're right. Yeah.
There's a little Mexican town within eyesight of the fort, right just across the border. And there was a brothel there that they would, that some of the guys would go to.
Uh-huh.
And Charlie
said. And you're not going to name them.
No, I'm not going to name them. But Charlie said one time he decided that it would be a good idea to go there with a stack of portraits of Ray Milland and give them to all the girls who immediately, and I think he autographed them too, and himself. Yeah. And so.
Great to see you, Ray.
Yes. All the girls hung it up in their cribs at the brothel.
So there was that's funny. That is very funny.
But,
and of course, Ray Milland at that time.
Oh yeah.
He was big, big deal.
Yeah. But finding stuff like that in the Warner Brothers, when you and I did the Objective Burma DVD commentary,
yeah.
just the things we found in there, a letter from Errol Flynn complaining about the location and how bad he felt he was being treated. And,
yeah, that's right. And, of course, in this particular instance, the way he wrote that letter...
Yeah, very funny.
With
yeah.
the accompanying photograph.
Yes.
That was, and he was mostly complaining about, you know, where they had the little makeshift dressing
yes.
room and the toilet area and what have you. And, of course, in this case, he was absolutely right.
Yes.
And fortunately, they did change it.
They had actually adapted one of the outhouses to be his dressing room.
Yes.
And he was very upset about that.
Oh, yeah.
But he was funny about it.
It was very well written.
Yeah,
not just
it was.
Funny, but the way he... And it was written, of course, to the big guns at the studio.
Yeah.
And they did change it. But he was also saying how that Betty Davis, when she goes on location,
so
forth.
Yeah, she doesn't have to put up with this sort of thing.
Yeah. And I think, and it, you know, in the picture, there he is sitting there smiling in front of this put-together...
Yeah.
You know, it looked like they spent 5 minutes throwing up something there that where he would change his clothes or go to the John or whatever. Anyway,
that's
and,
the, yeah.
you know what commentary that we did on Objective Burma. That you know, it's so great when you have somebody with whom you know you're going to be able to have a rapport with, versus wondering how it's three people suddenly get in there. And of course, John Burlingame was great.
Oh yeah,
if anybody knows. Music, film music, he does.
Yeah, I want to have him on this podcast
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, he's very good. He's, you know,
he knows a thing or two about...
He knows a lot about, and particularly, you know, those composers. And he's still writing, you know, for Variety about film music and
sure.
what have you. But anyway, it was great because he'd come in and talk about Franz Waxman, you know, and talk about this, that, and the other thing, and we'd come in and do our number, and it was, it all worked.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't always all work.
No.
And we won't go into that, will we?
It's always worked for me. That's all I can say.
Well, you're unique.
Well, that's true. Yes. yes. yeah. You can take that in whatever way you want to.
That's right. And I'm not going to tell you yes. how I'm taking it.
but, sometimes I think that researching these things becomes almost an end in itself. And I kind of regret that I have to finish that and write the piece because
yeah.
I love the research. Do you ever get in that, especially when I'm going through, say, trade papers,
yes.
1910, 1911, I just get so sidetracked by every page that I'm looking for something specific to what I'm writing about.
But then everything
gets me.
Yeah. And what happens, as you well know, you suddenly find yourself taking a lot of time with the extracurricular material there versus just concentrating on the thing at hand. But it's very difficult to do that when you're looking through, particularly a trade paper or something, you know, that is definitely reflecting the business and the
everything there is interesting.
Yeah, you know, but you go back to it and you think, oh, wait a minute, 1935, oh, yeah, that was the time that... and so forth. And it's hard. And you do, on occasion, if you're pressed for time, which we all are pressed for time on occasion, you have to kind of steel yourself to not get roped in on the extras, but let's concentrate on what we're looking for.
Sometimes when I'm in the Academy Library, because it's relatively easy to make photocopies at the microfilm machine there.
Yes.
And there's no limit to the number of copies you can make at the machine. There's a limit to the number of photocopies you can make out in the library itself.
Right.
So a lot of times if I see something that's interesting to me, I'll just think, I don't have time to read this now. Pop, hit the print, and just I'll just print it out. I'll read it later.
Right.
Something just went out of my head that I was...
You go out of my head, la da dee da 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 hum.
Oh, I remember now. We'll just make a little edit for that part. One time I was researching something at the Los Angeles Public Library.
The one in downtown?
Yeah. And it was in 1935 what I was looking for. And so I was having to read every page of the newspaper. I think it wasn't the LA Times, but it was something. And as I was going through every page of these 1935 papers, I noticed on the front page of each one was the Will Rogers column. So I just started reading them and thinking, well, this is kind of fun.
And suddenly ceased and desisted when he died.
Yeah, day by day. And then suddenly he starts writing, well, Wiley and I are heading out to Alaska tomorrow.
Boy.
And you have this weird feeling like suddenly you're kind of there and you're thinking, I got to stop this. I got to figure out how to stop this.
Yeah.
And it's easy to see how a fiction writer could come up with a fictional conceit about doing that, because you do kind of will yourself into these times when you get so bogged down in these papers.
You know that you were speaking of the downtown public library, downtown Los Angeles, and I remember going there quite a bit because, once again, you could go there on Saturday and all of that business when you weren't working. And at that, this would be before there was so much material on the internet and this and that and the other thing. And they did have these bound volumes where you could look through things, and newspaper, magazines, what have you. And, you know, this was great. And they had a lot of things that were somewhat arcane and obscure in addition to the obvious things, so that you could spend time just going through the original papers, which is great.
Yeah.
And I remember going over to UCLA on Sunday to their main library. You know, you start feeling out all this and when you can get there, because you just can't go any time during the week.
Yeah.
And it was so great because they were open on Sunday, and that was the main library. And, of course, they had special collections. They had this, that, and the other thing. I thought, once again, this is my Sunday number. The downtown public library was a Saturday number.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the various other places around. And then going to Larry Edmonds' bookstore, you had to squeeze that in.
Sure.
And that was always something, you know.
Yeah, luckily that's still there.
Luckily it's still there. And, you know, I remember first going to Larry Edmonds' bookstore around 1948. And it was over on... Cahuenga and near Selma. It was in a different building. And Milt Lubavitsky was the manager. And Git Lubavitsky, his wife, worked there. And it was great because they had a little film section. By film, I mean books on film.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, I'd go in there and look around, and he'd say, hey, there's a new book on... Well, you know, and suddenly things started to... And they moved up to Hollywood Boulevard, and now they're special... I mean, then... This would be in the 50s and 60s. They were specializing in film. But I remember those first days, you know, the film section was maybe about 4 feet wide. And, of course, it was terrific. It was a wonderful place. And that was, and people from out of town would go to Larry Edmonds if they were film buffs and so forth. And Milt would be yelling at his wife, hey, wait, do you have the... They'd be spread apart because she was upstairs doing something and he was down by the... And it was so funny. You'd hear all this back and forth stuff going on.
Yeah, it's weird to start getting nostalgic about things that have only been gone for 5 years or 10 years. The Collector's Bookstore right across from Larry Edmonds.
Oh, the Collector's
Bookstore.
Was
a magnificent place.
It was. And of course, the Pickwick Bookstore.
Oh, yeah.
Which was wonderful. And they had the used material on the second floor and the new, and it was vast.
Yeah.
We're not talking about a small little bookstore. And anyway, that's gone.
Yeah.
There's so many things gone. Another thing, too, which I'm sure you've done, I remember going over to the AFI a lot because they had not only these oral histories, which fortunately they were doing, but they also, were working on these books, these films of the 30s and the 40s and the what have you, which I thought was, a great thing to have because you've got all the details and it would be in two volumes or three volumes or what have you, and you could look things up. And again, you think, well, what's so unique about that? But it was a compression of a lot of information of when the film started shooting, when it was really, when it stopped, when it was released, who was in it, and people that aren't credited on the screen but were found in primary source materials. Anyway, that was another thing that was going on.
Yeah, that AFI catalog was a treasure.
And it still is a treasure.
Still is. And
unfortunately, you can get stuff online and all that, but those volumes, those red volumes.
Yep.
And of course, for me,
I had them all.
30s, 40s happened to be the major ones in my areas of interest.
Yeah, the 20s volumes, they didn't do with any kind of in-depth.
No, and the 20s volumes was before Pat Hansen.
Yeah.
And I'm not knocking the 20s volume, but the format.
I am.
You are. Can I go on record and say that you?
Yeah.
No, but then suddenly, with I guess it was the 40s or the 30s, whichever.
The 30s and 40s are both incredibly detailed.
Oh, yeah.
It's really great.
And that's, I still look at them all
the
time.
Oh, sure.
Checking
me too.
Out something, and so forth.
Yeah. And they're working, they still work on that stuff. Bob Burchard is in charge of it now.
That's right.
And,
yeah.
So they're updating all the time, and I think
that's good.
I think little by little the 20s is going to get fixed up like the 30s and 40s.
I think that would be the one to get fixed up.
Yeah.
I mean, not to knock the teens and all that, but there's something that would really benefit the 20s.
Sure. And we know a lot of stuff about the production of a lot of those movies now that we could
that's right.
We could get in there. So everything is changing in terms of the way we research this, and it's interesting because a lot of people think that now you can do all your research online. Well, you can't do all your research online.
No, you can't. And also, I hate to say it, but you can't believe everything that's online.
No.
And that's not to knock the convenience and all of this stuff. It's a great way to check out things, but you can't say that that's it. I mean, there are errors there. There's errors everywhere.
Well, sure. Well,
in your case.
Well, of course, yeah. That goes without saying.
Yes.
And, and yet you said it.
So. I said it.
To go back to Objective Burma, because this is a great example, I think.
Objective, Burma,
exclamation point.
Let's always be sure everyone understands.
We'll just say it. Objective Burma.
Yeah. Or Objective Burma.
Burma. This was a great example to me of what you can find online and what you can't. Because in the Warner Brothers archive, we found incredible things, memos, daily production reports, all of this stuff that gave us day by day minute detail about making that movie.
That's right.
But I found online, simply by a fluke, just going in and just trying everywhere, I found a 1944 magazine from the Signal Corps.
I remember, and you talk about that.
Yeah. And
it was great because it augments and also gives a different point of view and at the time it was happening.
And one of the things that was in this magazine was they talk about the guys who took the stock footage that's in that movie.
Yes.
And so whereas we always look at stock footage and think, well, it's just stock footage. In this case, we not only know who took it all, but when it was taken and where it was.
Yes.
And they interviewed some guys who had been in the Burmese campaign.
Right, yeah.
And they were showing them objective Burma and
pointing
out. And they were pointing out. Oh, when you know when it had footage of them pushing supplies out of a cargo plane.
Yeah.
And one of the guys said, "Oh, I was one of the guys down on the ground when that stuff came down." And that's a perfect online sort of experience because
absolutely.
Where in the world would I have ever found
no,
that?
No, and fortunately,
or even thought
you
to
found
look,
it
you know?
Was very close to when we actually did our session.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's represented. It's not just kind of a throwaway line. And it's got some very good information.
Really terrific information.
Yeah.
And also, they showed the film to some veterans of the Burma campaign.
That's right.
And that was really interesting because they were reacting to it as somebody who had been there.
Right.
And it was really interesting for them to say what came off as being pretty genuine.
Yeah.
And what didn't. I mean, obviously, you take a little bit of Hollywood
sure,
in there.
Sure.
But I remember one of the most striking things to me was that it said that every time one of the Japanese soldiers was killed in the movie, the guys would burst into laughter. And
I remember, and that shocked me.
It did. It was interesting. It was because you don't... These days, and this came up when we were watching The Pacific, which I thought was a terrific miniseries on HBO, but there was a scene where there was a Japanese attack at night. And so the guys were sort of just shooting into the dark.
Mm-hmm.
And then as the sun rose, they see this sea of bodies that and after the show, my wife said, "Can you imagine how horrible that would be to just be confronted with this?" And I said, "I got to tell you, it might have been, but on the other hand, I think, you know, judging from what these guys said in this Objective Burma article, I think they were so delighted to have lived through it that it wasn't horrible at all. That they were just, oh, look at all those dead people, and we're alive. And it really did, it did give you a little bit of a shift in thinking about how, I mean, certainly the trauma is there, and there was a lot of what we now call post-traumatic stress in World War II veterans.
Right.
It's interesting to look at a movie through those eyes and to see that even the guys who had been there found Objective Burma to be pretty close to the mark in terms of authenticity.
Yes, and as we certainly talked about on the commentary track, it relatively speaking, when you look at some of the other war films, particularly the ones made during World War II, and Objective Burma was still during World War II, you know, they're obviously of a different... Some of them are fine. I'm not knocking them. And a lot of it's gung-ho, and a lot of it is, hey. But Objective Burma was, at the time even, and certainly in retrospect, deemed pretty close to, you know, at least what sort of happened. You know, there's a fictional story in there, but there was the bringing back of... Anyway, we won't go into all that, but... It is. I think it still holds up.
I do too. And it's, but it's a question with movies always, isn't it? About when movies try to depict a real event, do we judge the movie on how well it depicted that event, or do we judge the movie on
dramatic
reasons? Because you can't really depict war completely authentically. You just can't do it. So everything has to be changed a little bit, and
well, it's, you know, it's once again it's dramatized, and of course so many of the things try to be as close as possible, which is, but you know, you're compressing things, you're being selective about things, you're being wary about how people would react to such a thing, you know there are so many considerations, plus the box office.
Yes. Well, one thing, and I'd love to hear you speak to this, is because we know periods of, and we're interested in the past, and
the past is prologue.
The past is prologue.
Yeah.
The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there.
Yes.
That it's interesting to me when movies ignore the realities of the past, or when they try to do it with some authenticity, and I see it all the time in movies of the 50s, especially, that they just didn't care at all
about movies
made in the 50s.
Made in the
50s. when, like, you look at something like Man of a Thousand Faces, yeah, or something like that, there is no feeling of the actual,
yeah, right,
period in any way.
Mm-hmm. And the Buster Keaton story.
Oh, Buster Keaton story. Yeah, awful.
Yeah.
And
certainly Buster Keaton wasn't awful. Nor his friends.
No. And it's very strange, isn't it, that... But I remember when I was working on my Wellman book, the first one, I was at University of Wisconsin in Madison,
yeah,
where they had the Warner Brothers stuff.
Yes, yeah.
And there was a movie called Frisco Jenny.
Yes.
And
Ruth Chatterton.
Yeah, Ruth Chatterton takes place at the time of the quake.
Yeah. The San Francisco earthquake of 1906.
Yes.
I mean, that's my hometown.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. So the funny quake is what I'm talking about. And early in the script, there's a line that says, and this is 1931 or 32 film. Early on in the script, it says...
I think it's a tad later. I could be wrong. But it doesn't matter. It's early 30s.
Yes.
How does that? That gets us off the hook.
Yes. Early 30s. Look it up, folks. We can't do everything for
That's
you.
That's right.
Early on in the script, there's a line that says, and I'm paraphrasing, but it says, "Be sure and accentuate the ridiculous fashions of the day." And so in 1932... they're saying, look how stupid people looked in 1906, and let's make sure that we make fun of this in the movie so that everyone can laugh at how funny.
Yeah.
And I think, isn't that always the way that for some reason everything in the past has been absurd until now? And now everything's fine. But everything previous to this has been stupid.
I think that's a good point. I don't think I'm always agreeing with you on that.
Mm.
Only because, you know, I think there is a greater resonance with the past on certain things where people are trying to be as accurate as possible without being a pastiche or, you know, words
sure,
like that. Isn't that ridiculous? And I do feel that that's, you know, been around for a while. I agree with you that certainly it many years ago, it was always like, well, you know, but not. I get the feeling, mostly in the last many, many years, that there's a great deal of attention to detail, and you don't want to, you know, make fun of something. You want to be as accurate as you can. Now, where there's always that exception, because when you get to a woman's face, there's that, we don't want to go too far there because people, you know, won't actually accept that. So you still do things. I remember when they were doing things in the 30s where the eyebrows, you know,
yeah,
and if it was a medieval picture, you know, like Robin or Nears Olivia to Heaven with her, they try to kind of play it from both ends so that you won't disappoint people who are looking at this without a historic frame of reference.
Sure.
And you won't totally upset the people with a historical frame of reference. So like with the costuming and the makeup and the so forth, you kind of do a little bit of a blend so that you're hopefully not displeasing both crowds completely. But I have noticed, it seems to me, maybe I'm... that there seems to be more attention to making it right in terms of the look, the texture, the materials, the ambiance, and the so forth. Now, you know, I realize that this is somewhat subjective.
Yeah. No, certainly there have been many films that seem to try very hard.
Yeah, yeah.
To get things right. And I look at things, I've been watching Boardwalk Empire on HBO, yeah, and that seems very good to me.
Yeah,
I mean,
the hair
seems right.
Right.
Because hair is always the first thing to go wrong.
Yes, yes.
Always the first thing to go wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
And
that's why they used to wear wigs so much.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of the male performers. Yeah,
exactly.
Seriously. Because,
yeah,
of course, the haircuts of the 30s are and they put on a wig.
Sure.
If it was a period thing.
Yeah.
And, of course, we were up to our neck in wigs galore, right?
Yeah, I've always heard that... one of the reasons there have been relatively few movies about the Revolutionary War is that major stars just didn't want to wear ponytails and
yeah,
the
right
kind of things that would have to be done for
yes
that. And
Well, even, you know, the old story with Clark Gable and Newt on the Bounty, which is 1935, mm-hmm. picture obviously about olden times, he didn't want to wear the ponytail thing. And he was not too happy doing that period thing. But he did, and it was fine. But, you know, there's that apprehension. And, gee, we're, you know. And, of course, he did have his regular hair. It was just augmented.
Yeah.
with a fall and whatever you have to do, you know, yeah. to make it look right. But it's always interesting. And the choice is to, okay, now we're not going to have a wig. You're going to wear your own hair. But maybe we'll put a fall in the back.
Sure.
You know, that kind of thing.
Well, it's also funny what we find beautiful and, like, for instance, in 1932, that scriptwriter was saying, let's make fun of 1906, whereas if you made a movie about 1906 now, people would say, look at how beautifully they dressed and look at those hats.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So now it's taken on a different
that's
look.
Right. That's
I mean,
right.
I'm convinced that that was part of the reason Titanic was such a successful film, was because it's a period that now we find to be so elegant. And everybody with those great, the women with their great dresses and those huge hats and all that, it just looks very lovely to us.
That's right. And it's the same with so many of these British period things that are either on television or on features or, where it's elegance and, of course, it's the caste system, but it's all somehow charming because of it's totally alien to what we know in terms of now, and yet there is a certain nostalgia, and not for people that had been through it, but there's something that's fascinating to people about those old days and the manners, not the manners and customs, but the manor houses and the caste system and the so forth, and it is upstairs, downstairs, you know, all of that stuff resonates and has for many years and continuing series, which are quite popular, as you know. So it is amazing. There is, I think, we don't look back in anger.
No, what I think I hear a lot these days is somebody will say, well, you know, 10 years ago, I had to use a payphone because, you know, how else could I call anybody? And everybody will kind of snicker, like, can you believe there was no cell phones? I mean, what a weird time that must have been.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it was 10 years ago.
That's right, I know.
It wasn't ancient history. It was,
and, you know, I was thinking about this the other day for some reason, but I remember whenever I was going any place, particularly if I was going somewhere during where I had to check in at the office, you know, something like that, I always had to find where the payphone was, obviously, because, you know, that was it. And I was a big believer in checking in all the time, because our main office, when I was with Leo Burnett, was in Chicago. And, of course, with the time difference and everything, you never knew when. This is when it didn't matter. You weren't in the middle of a shoot or anything like that, or prepping or editing. But it was like, you know, in another week we're going to be starting. Well, I'd be checking in, but it would, wherever I went. Now, where's the payphone? And, of course, the payphones were all over the place, right? And it wasn't very expensive either. So I had a lot of dimes, and I had a lot of quarters, and a lot. And that was standard operating procedure, that I would be sure that I had enough money for the payphone.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, it's in some ways, we live in a great time, you know. We live because, you know, the car breaks down, you just get out your phone and call AAA. And it's like things that would have been huge traumas just a few years ago.
I know.
You're absolutely right.
I
mean, ATMs everywhere, you don't run out of cash, unless you don't have any in the bank. But, you know, you need, everything is very simple for us in many ways. So.
Relatively, you know, it's interesting, it's almost a paradox. It's relatively simple, but extraordinarily complicated. I mean, the life that we now have. Of course, to some people, it's standard operating procedure. But having been through the earlier times, and, of course, being older, you know, nothing's easy anymore. Of course, I thought it was easy then, and maybe, you know, it wasn't that easy, but you were used to it. That you have to take that into account, too. But with all the conveniences, which I think are terrific, and the internet, you know, and looking up things and the Wikipedias and the what have, and again, as long as you use a little bit.
Caution,
I think is the, but I mean, think of that. You know, what did we, people sometimes, they don't even leave the house. They're not going to places to research something. They're doing it on, which again is good and bad.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's.
But in terms of figuring out where to go for something,
yes.
I mean, even if you have to go to an archive to research, you can still do your preliminary legwork online.
Exactly.
Or you can, you know, you email Kevin Brownlow or ask a question. Hey, what about this Harry Davidy Durast? What's going on with
him? And you get, and mostly you can get an instant reply of some kind or another. And, you know, that's such a big plus. Because I remember, you know, doing the airmail to England or whatever, and of course you waited for a week and a half or so, if you got an instant reply, would be a week and a half, right?
Well, but it also ties into, for lack of a better word, passion, I guess, because it almost the accessibility of everything devalues everything in some weird way.
Yeah.
When I was becoming passionate about movies, grew up in South Carolina, there was no way to see old movies except on TV.
Uh-huh.
And that was very sporadic, and it just happened to be what it happened to be.
Yeah.
There was no way in the world for me to say, boy, I'd love to see Intolerance, because where in the world would I see it?
Yeah.
Nowhere.
Yeah.
When I got to Boston, there were a lot of repertory theaters, there were a lot of colleges with film societies that sort of thing. And so it became a lot more accessible, but you still had to wait for things to come along.
Oh, sure.
But now you got a big shelf full of DVDs, and if you can get something on demand, you can go to Hulu. Only something really rare is not completely accessible to you this very minute.
That's right.
And I wonder if you know, how when we were kids, when I was a kid, how you'd look forward to The Wizard of Oz coming on television once a year, mm-hmm. and you looked forward to it, and that was the night that it was on, and if you didn't see it,
You didn't see it, yeah.
And now, a kid that has no experience of that at all,
no.
Does that make Wizard of Oz more or less important to that kid? Because it was very important to us.
Well,
And it really got deep into our hearts, you know, that these films.
No, I understand. Yeah. And believe me, because when I was growing up in the 30s, if you didn't see the movie when it came out, you didn't see the movie. You know, once it played, the big, I think I may have mentioned this the other time we talked, but if you didn't see it downtown in San Francisco, where you had the first run theaters, and then 2 months later at the neighborhood houses, that was it. It was gone. And only on a rare occasion would there be a definite reissue of kind. But, you know, that's what you had. I remember, kind of living down here since 1946, there were so many things in the 50s, 60s, 70s, where there were theaters all over this greater Los Angeles area where you could go to see an old movie. You know, a reissue, but not a reissue, but they just got a print of it.
Yeah.
You know, between the Vagabonds and the New Arts, and of course the County Art Museum, and you know, all these places that you could find that they were showing something. And I remember when I was doing America's Favorite Movies, also known as Behind the Scenes, these films were playing. I mean, not all at the same time, but over that 2.5-3 year period, you know, oh, they're showing Stagecoach down at the back. Oh, they're showing at the, and over at the, you know. And it was great. You'd get in your car and you'd drive to see these movies somewhere.
Yeah.
And certainly at the County Art Museum, because they were showing a lot of stuff then. And the Academy was showing a lot of stuff. And, you know, I mean, it was, and the universities, you know, UCLA was showing stuff out there all the time. And it was, this was how you saw your old movies. Or you rented a 16mm print from Films Incorporated or, you know, all these other places that were around. But that was expensive. if you wanted to buy a rent, a 16 millibit, it could be $30 a night.
Yeah.
But if you were working on something and there was no other way you could see that particular number, you'd sometimes pop for it. And
sure.
You'd get that print and bring it back the next day.
Yeah.
And that went on budget films. I remember that was...
Oh, yeah. I read many a film from
those.
So
did I.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was great. And I remember, I must mention this, because in 1966, the circa, my pilgrimage to the Eastman House back in Rochester. You know, this was a big deal. It was James Card was then at the time. And I this was something I had always wanted to do. I'd read so much about it and all this. So I had my list of films I'd like to see if I went back there for 3 day or 4 day, whatever it would happen to be. Anyway, so I got yeses and noes and whatever. So I went back to the East. This was my vacation. Of course, people at where I worked thought, you're going to do what? Going back to Rochester to see some old movies? Ah, good, really. Anyway, so I'd go back there, and you'd book this time, and I would sit in that theater from 8:30 in the morning until 5 o'clock with these things that I was watching. And, of course, there were things that I couldn't find anywhere else. And see, some of them were just out of general interest. Some of them were specific to things that I was very much interested or wanted to do something with. But it was such a great thing, and I was there for three... And then 2 years later, I went back again to see more. Now, you know...
Did you meet Louise Brooks while you were there?
No, this was right after... I think she was still living there, but it was after the... But James Card was telling me about this, you know, and so forth. And sometimes he'd come in and sit while I was watching something. And he's the one who suggested, it wasn't on my list, that I watch Pandora's Box. And of course, what did I know, you know? And I watched, and of course it was fascinating.
Yeah.
And I was getting some stories while the thing was running, which is, of course, even more. And anyway, it was a great experience, you know, it really was, because at that time, it was unique. And they had prints of all kinds of things, as you well know. And my list was a rather eclectic list, to say the least. And it was, you know, it was some stuff that I thought, I should really see this. And I did. There's another fellow back there, George Pratt. And George was so helpful on so many things, because he had a lot of photographs. And I mean, a part of the Eastman House. So I'd ask, do you have anything for you? And he would have something. It was like going over to the British Film Institute, which I did when I was working on The Adventures of Robin, not The Adventures of Robin Hood, but The Adventures of the Flynn book for Citadel. The films of Errol Flynn, you know, they had all kinds of stuff that you couldn't get over here in their still collection, because they had different stills from what the American distribution was, in some cases.
Sure.
And they had stuff from, you know, from his British films, which was awfully good. Murder at Monte Carlo, for example.
Yeah.
Which, of course, you couldn't find anything. And here they had photographs from. Anyway. But, you know, once again, another institution.
Yeah.
And which was unique because they had British journals, of course, and files on films and so forth and so on. So you could, and the timing was, I was working over there at the time on a project, so it was kind of for 4 weeks. So it was like an extracurricular activity going to the British Film Institute. And, you know, there we go.
I've always wanted to go there. Anyone listening to this podcast who lives in England, who wants to bring me over there to give a talk or something,
I'm available. I'm sure you're going to get a raft of...
You think so?
Yeah, maybe one.
I should start packing right now.
No, I wouldn't go that far.
Oh, you wouldn't?
No, I'd kind of hold off, but okay. Live in hope.
I always do.
You know, when I started, we talked about writing for Films and Review with that, the story behind the making of Movies Golden Age, which I was asked to do that television special. And then I thought, hey, you know, so I started submitting ideas to Henry Hart, the editor, of some other things. Anyway, many of which, he said, okay. Well, one of them was on Clara Bow.
Hmm.
Now, once again, this would have been about 1962. This was at Channel 13 over in La Brea. They moved, and Baxter Ward was our newscaster. It was very good. He had been in the 50s and 60s, and later became a supervisor and so forth. Anyway, I was sitting in his office one day, and it was near Christmas time, and I saw this. He had some cards up on the wall, and I saw this one was from Clara Bow. And I guess she was a fan of Baxter Ward and had written him from Culver City, where she was living at the time, and it had this P.O. box on it, a return P.O. box of her address. And she was saying, "Hi, Baxter, I'm still, you know, blah, blah, blah," little note, and a Christmas card. So I said to him, I said, "Baxter, do you know Clara Bow?" He said, "No, I don't. I've just, you know, she's sent me cards for the last several years. And she's very nice and has little notes and so forth and so on." And I said, "Would you mind if I took down her post office box address?" No. Anyway, to cut to the chase, because I thought Clara Bow hadn't really been, at that time, you know, there was a story there that hadn't really been fulfilled.
Sure.
So I wrote her, and I said in the letter, to the effect, I said, "Baxter, I work at Channel, you know, Baxter Ward is our news reporter, and I know that you," and I said, "I'm doing an article for you on Films and Review," which I had mentioned to Henry Hart, and he said, "Oh, great, Chuck Clara Bow, oh my God." And I had done a lot of research, and anyway, I said, "I would very much like to, you know, meet with you, and if that's not possible, perhaps we could talk on the phone, and if that's not possible, would you mind if I wrote and asked you some questions for this article?" I didn't get a response. Okay. So time goes on, I'm doing my research, and I'm getting, you know, all kinds of things which are at the Academy Library or wherever I found them. And then I wrote her, I said, "I'm sending off the draft of the article to New York, to Films and Review. I thought perhaps you might want to look it over in case there's anything in here that you find is a terrible mistake or what have you, or that you would like to..." Well, that did it. Now, actually, I wasn't sending it off quite yet. But it was complete mm-hmm. in terms of what I was going to say, but I was ready for more. And fortunately, she responded. And on the copy, the typewritten copy of the time, she annotated it on the sides and on the bottom of the pages and on an additional page. She said, "This is entirely, whatever, you know, and, or, this is true, but no, however, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera." And I thought, talk about luck. Now, this is Clara, and then I did talk to her on the phone. Now, she was a bit of a recluse at that time, you know, when she was living alone, but mm-hmm. she did have this kind of companion nurse who was living with her. And anyway, to cut to the chase, she definitely wasn't going to see me, but she talked briefly on the phone to me. And so I incorporated various things in the manuscript that she, I'm quoting her, obviously, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, you, this is her feeling about it or her opinion, you know, it wasn't like, or she said in a correction, she said, blah, blah, blah. Well, of course, it made it so much more interesting
sure.
to hear from Clara at the time in retrospect versus quotes from earlier. And that was what was published. And I was always so happy about that. And I don't know whether she was happy that she had done this or that she was being quoted that much. I wrote her, I sent her the copy of through the post office box copy. I never heard back. So I don't know whether she was happy about it or unhappy or just figured, hey, that's enough of that. But anyway, and fortunately, I have that. It's in my collection at the Academy, that manuscript with all of her annotations, which, you know, are wonderful.
I'll go down and look at that one of these.
Well, it's you know, there are various things that we all have, that letters from or different things, and interviews with, and which I have cassettes there and all that. But it's so nice, you know, with something like that, to see this, particularly if from somebody like Clara Bow, who you're certainly not going to hear from anymore, and reacting to her whole life up to that point. Which, of course, was like kind of act three.
Yeah.
You know, because it wasn't that much later that she died. But anyway, enough of that.
Yeah, she couldn't have been that much in demand at the time. I mean, there was, because there wasn't a long period of time when people just didn't have that much interest in those.
No, that's right. Now, I'm thinking in 1962-3, around in there, probably that wasn't, although there was interest, but it wasn't like, you know, amazing, oh, gee, we're going back to the 20s. But I think she was such a kind of a crystallized figure of that, the Roaring 20s, of the It Girl and all of that business, mm-hmm. you know. But, and the same thing with Marion C. Cooper, who was still alive in 1964.
Yeah.
And living out in Pacific Palisades, and I go out to interview him, and I've got, you know, like 3 hours on wow. tape talking about his whole career, you know, and which Films and Review published. And thank God, because we got into Chang and Grass and King Kong and, you know, and all of this, plus this is Cinerama, because that was relatively recent, you know, at the time I was interviewing.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I saw him for lunch and saw him here and there. And anyway.
And King Kong was a really big film for you, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Mm. It was a big film. I didn't get to see it. You know, I think we may have talked about this. I don't recall. But in 1933, when I was a kid, because I think it was on that list. No. That's a little too much for... But they reissued it in perpetuity, and I think I saw it first in 1939 at the reissue. And of course, I thought it was just unbelievable. And then I saw it in the 40s, obviously in the 50s. It was like, you know, it was a hearty perennial, right? Mm. And of course, I thought it was great. And by the time I saw Cooper, you know, and I had worked in stop motion at that time over with the Pillsbury Doughboy at the Cascade. Jim Danforth and Phil Kellison and the gang, which is another story, but it was done in stop motion, the Doughboy. Anyway, and he was had a, you know, he was articulated with his armature and everything, so he'd do a frame at a time. And I was producing those for the first 3 years when that started in 1966, somewhere in there. Anyway, so it was great, you know, with all of that, and then, you know, when you had the opportunity to write about this, you could draw upon our Cooper and my correspondence and stuff that he gave me,
wow.
copies of memos and what have you, because he was another one of these guys who saved everything. And you know, the fact that here was this letter to David Selznick, you know, at RKO,
yeah,
and saying, I've looked at Creation, the you know what they've had. What we should do, and, you know, that was what they were going to do, and Selznick had asked him to look into it and see if it hadn't shot yet. This is
yeah.
Lois O'Brien's. Anyway, so you've got all this stuff. Once again, primary source material, you know. So I was always happy about that kind of thing, that I was able to see some of these people, or at least deal with them before they had folded their tent.
Yeah.
And after all, folding of the tent is mandatory somewhere down the line, right?
Somewhere. Well, he was the real deal. I mean, Cooper and Chodzak were not only great filmmakers, but real adventurers.
Oh, I mean, they without were, question, without yeah. question. And, you know, Cooper, as he told me, and which is hardly, wanted to be an explorer, you know, when he was a kid, after having read this one book about Darkest Africa, which had mean gorillas in them. Anyway, but, you know, so it wasn't something that somehow... And they were doing these adventurous trips at a time when they were adventurous. You know, and going
sure.
to these rather remote places with for Grass and for Chang, you know. And, you know, by the time they got to King Kong, it was, hey, now we can do this in Hollywood. And
great
meeting
stuff.
And having to meet at that time, you know, to see about the stop-motion bit, because that's what Planet, that he originally wanted to do King Kong in another way. You know, bring a gorilla over to, what was the place where they had the Komodo, where they had the dragon lizards of Komodo, and by special effect, you know, do that kind of thing, and then bring them to the New York Zoo and all that. Anyway, but when he went, during the Depression, of course, nobody's going to finance this sort of a trip. So when he saw Willis O'Brien's stop-motion effect with the dinosaurs, that's when he thought, that's how we can do Kong. So, that you know, that story,
yeah.
which is hardly, you know, it's been around for a long time, but it's a fascinating story.
It really is. And it's amazing how effective that film always has been and always will be.
That's right.
I watched the remake of King Kong, the Peter Jackson remake, which was lovely in many ways.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, they did a lot of things really right, and it did.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw it once, and that'll do me.
Yeah.
But
I've seen King Kong
for 20 times, I guess.
Yeah, and when you realize, you know, what they were doing at that time, and it is, you know, it was late 32, early 33, and so forth. And what went into that thing? And it was so imaginative. And what the processes they were using. They used everything that was even somewhat on the radar. Because, you know, not only the stop motion, which of course had been around for a while, but it was used much more elaborately. And the rear screen projection, which was relatively new. And then the miniature rear screen projection, which was new. And then you had, you know, all of these traveling mats, which were, you know.
Yeah.
But the fact that you could blend all of this stuff and make it work on the stage and on the little miniature stage, you know, it was something that, and plus that Max Steiner score.
Yeah.
You know, when you realize at a time when there weren't that many full scores in movies, talking movies, that was a major number. So that it goes on, you know, and on. And the fact that it had so much life over the years. Talk about reissues, you know.
Sure.
And each one did extraordinarily well.
Well, there's so much personality in that film. And in Kong himself. I mean, for being essentially a puppet.
Yes,
He really comes to life in that thing.
You're right. I'll never forget, you know. And Cooper was very nice to me, and then he moved down to Coronado, and I wrote him that I was doing this book, a memo from David O. Selznick, and of course he knew Selznick very well. And he said, I asked him if he had anything vapor-wise. Well, he did have things, but unfortunately they weren't, except for a couple of things, they weren't from Selznick. They were from Cooper to Selznick, which I wouldn't have worked in a memo from David O. Selznick, but he was, you know, willing to help and all of that.
Nice.
And I remember one time when he called me, this was earlier, and he called me on the phone. He said, Rudy, Dave Selznick died. And he had this kind of interesting voice. I'm not probably doing it properly. And Dave Selznick died. And it was when David O. Selznick died. And he was the one calling me on the phone to give me the news.
Wow.
Anyway, that's that.
Yeah, it's been a charmed life for you, huh? To be able to meet some of your heroes like that.
Yes, and the timing, and, you know, and all of that, which I am ever grateful, seriously, because, you know, there were a lot of things you wish you could, but the fact that that person was alive, or these files showed up, or this happened, or the timing on that, without being I mean, it's a cliche, but timing is so much of it, don't you think?
Sure.
And the fact that something shows up at the right time for you, and that someone shows up at the right time for you, or a project, or whatever. I mean, you have to be grateful for something like that, because you can't just assume, you know. And there are a lot of people who would be perfectly capable of doing so many, but the timing isn't right. I shouldn't say a lot of people, but there's certainly some people who would be capable of doing one thing and another, but the timing isn't right. So I can't complain.
Yeah.
Do you want to hear some complaints?
Yeah, go ahead. Hey, I can match you complaint for complaint, believe me.
Really?
Oh, sure.
I'm just quickly looking, just in case. Speaking of, if I may, just for a second, of the timing, I was able to get to Technicolor. I wanted to do an article on the history of Technicolor.
Mm-hmm.
This was once again for Films and Review in the mid-60s or somewhere in there. Well, they were still down, you know, their main plant was still down in Cahuenga, in this big building, and it was still Technicolor, you know. And fortunately, I went down there, and I had met this gentleman who was the head of the legal department. And fortunately, he was extremely helpful and was opening up files for me and screening prints that they had on hand of certain things. Now, this was before a lot of this stuff was rediscovered, you know. I saw one reel of Becky Sharp. one reel. As you know, that went through a lot of big problems there, putting it all together. And I saw one reel of La Cucaracha, which was, you know, a milestone mm-hmm. at this time. But to see this stuff, and one reel of a Spanish print of The Mystery of the Wax Museum in the two-color Technicolor, which, of course, at that particular time, in 1964 or whenever it was, this wasn't something, that was one of sure. those films that they hadn't found yet, The Mystery of the Wax Museum. And, of course, with the two-color, it was the end of the two-color Technicolor time. So you were able to see, with a good print, the dye transfer, thank God,
wow.
because when they brought out the DeMille Ten Commandments Technicolor from 1923, it was all the print. It was just, it wasn't the whole movie, but it was Technicolor scenes that they shot. It was all just gone completely.
Wow.
But that was before the dye transfer for the two-color,
yeah.
which occurred in the late 20s. And, you know, you knew that they had shot the stuff because it was definitely, you know, in the files and recorded and the reviews and all that. But
there's some of that that exists, doesn't it? Some
well,
of the color?
It the Technicolor, according to what I found out at the time, didn't still exist.
Hmm.
Now, there were stuff, and I have to qualify this, I'm not positive, but that was before the dye transfer, because the DeMille picture came out in 23,
yeah.
and they started doing, because even the Black Pirate wasn't dye transfer,
yeah.
and you know, that had to go through several major restoration things, because it was when they had the two pieces of film, you know, that were
sure.
together. Yeah. Can you imagine that, with everything going out of focus and so forth and so forth? But I think it was around 1927 when they came to the, which lasted until 33 when the three strip came.
Yeah.
But it was two strip, I guess, for a while. But anyway, that was fascinating. And again, you know, that went away. You know, that particular, that Technicolor of it.
Yeah.
And fortunately, here was somebody who not only was there, but had access to the materials and was helping me. And then had people look at the manuscript to be, from a Technicolor standpoint, to be sure that there wasn't anything. So, talk about, once again, timing.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, sometimes serendipity, things will just come along when they need to. That's happened
right.
to me.
That's right.
More than once.
And it happened, I'm sure it has, and the Korngold, meeting Eric Korngold's son, and having access, you know, to do an article on his father. You know, and he lived over in Toluca Lake in the family home where Eric lived. You know, so all of those things, again, that was in the 60s.
And did he have a lot of Korngold's materials and the scores
God,
and all that?
Yes.
Wow.
And then, you know, and of course, George, the son, one of two sons, was also a music editor and worked in the business.
Hmm.
So, and he produced that first album, music by Eric Wolfgang Korngold, that came out on Warner Brothers around 60-something. Well, that was a big deal because it used the original orchestrations,
yeah.
and they were suites that they put together. And, you know, Newman, not Alfred, but his brother.
Emil?
Not Emil, the other brother, whose name I know as well as my own, who was
yes.
the composer. Anyway, who was at Fox, and at that time, he was working at Fox, George Korngold. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But they went over and recorded this stuff in Germany, and it came out in an album. Well, at that particular time, in the early 60s, you couldn't hear that stuff. And here, suddenly, I'm crying as I'm playing the record. Because, you know, this is music that I was growing up with, but you couldn't hear it on record.
Sure.
They weren't doing film scores on record, you know, at that time. So that was a big deal. I got it. He gave it to me at a New Year's Eve party, an advanced copy of the LP.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going home, and my first wife and I sat up and listening to it. She finally went, I sat up until dawn listening and crying.
Wow.
I must have played that two-sided LP 15 times, you know. And this is, you know, 2 and 3 and 4 in the morning. But it was that important.
Sure.
To hear this music played by a symphony orchestra when the original arrangements and orchestration from Warner Brothers.
There have been things like that have happened in my life that have just come out of the blue. Things that I hoped for my entire life, and then suddenly, bang, there it is.
I know.
And it's
and when that happens,
amazing when it happens.
It's, yeah. It is so exciting, isn't it?
And this interview has been one of those things.
You mean to tell me?
Yes, absolutely.
Now I got to go. I'm speaking for you.
I've dreamed since I was in the first grade of coming to your and sitting in your kitchen and talking
since you
movies.
Were in the first grade, and
yes.
I guess at that time I was probably 50, right?
No. No, you and I are roughly the same age.
No, so. Roughly is right.
Yes.
But anyway, so, no, it's been great. Frank.
I can't tell you what a pleasure it's been for me.
You probably cut it down by 30%. But anyway, oh, maybe 40.
All the outtakes are going to go in on this thing. This is
than virtually everyone wants to know.
But as a matter of fact, if I'm going to get one of those renowned Rudy Belmer impersonators to come in and do even more, so.
Uh-oh.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
there's a few
renowned.
Of those. You can find them everywhere these days.
Well, listen, some of the impersonations that I've heard are incredible. Not of,
not of you.
Not of me, but, I mean, you think, geez. And, of course, you have to have a satire edge to them to make them work. That's why there's so many people, you know, who, I mean, relatively famous people, that you at one of these people can't imitate because they don't have any of those characteristics that
yeah.
you can play upon.
Yeah, you got to have a Bogart voice or a
yeah.
Cary Grant voice.
Yeah.
I was interviewing by phone Peter Ustinov one
oh.
time, and he was a dead-on mimic. As you must know, he
yes,
could do anybody.
Yeah.
So we were talking along, and toward the end of the conversation, he was in—I think he was in France or somewhere. So we were talking by phone, and I realized that he was talking to me in a voice that sounded very familiar. And then I realized that he was doing me—that he, that he was talking back to me in my voice.
I think that's terrific.
And,
now, did he gradually segue to that, or did it? I mean, he obviously didn't start that way.
Yeah, no, just
but
toward the end, yeah.
Toward the end, and he did it in a subtle way, right?
Yeah.
So it wasn't like a hard transition.
No.
I think that's terrific. And you were saying, wait a minute.
Yeah, hey.
That's me.
Get out of my head, Peter Ustinov. That's what I said.
Was it a good interview?
It was.
Yeah.
I was doing, It was when Kirk Douglas was getting the Life Achievement Award,
uh-huh.
and it was about the time that Spartacus had just been restored.
Uh-huh.
And so I interviewed him, Gene Simmons, of course, Kirk, did 5-hour-long interviews with Kirk Douglas over the course of a week.
Five? With Kirk himself?
Yeah.
Gee.
And Tony Curtis.
Now, you were speaking strictly about Spartacus, but he made...
With Kirk, I was speaking about his entire career.
Oh, you were?
With the others, I was speaking specifically about Spartacus.
Oh,
so,
gee, well, that must have been something with
yes.
Kirk with his entire
and
career.
And this, I'll tell you why I will never forgive Sissy Spacek as long as I live. You heard me, Sissy Spacek. I'm coming at... I was... He was getting the Life Achievement Award by the AFI, and I was writing a piece for American Film Magazine.
Yeah.
And he was doing a film in the Pyrenees in Spain, at the border of Spain and France.
Yeah.
So the Universal people said to the American Film people, if you will make sure that he's on the cover of the magazine, then we, Universal, will fly your author to the Pyrenees to do the interview there.
Yeah.
And American Film Magazine thought about it and decided Sissy Spacek would be better for the cover of that issue.
Oh.
I went, doggone it. I was that close to going to the Pyrenees.
Oh, geez.
But what it turned out to be was I...
Well, where did you interview Kirk then?
Just by phone.
By phone, okay.
Yeah. Every day I would watch Kirk Douglas movies all day.
Yeah.
And then at the end of his work day, which was about... 3 o'clock by time, he was expecting my call at the hotel. So I would call him up, and we would talk for an hour or so, and then...
Gee, I think that's great.
It was really fun.
And I'm sure that he gave a good interview.
And one day, we were talking, and he said, Oh, excuse me. My son Mike just walked in. And Mike, if you'll sit down, I'm finishing up right now. And I thought, oh, Mike, Michael Lewis, he's like, he just walked in the room in the Pyrenees. So,
yeah.
As it happens,
so he did. He went into his stage work and went into his.
Yeah, we went. We did the whole thing. I did a big career article for
now
American
Film.
Now
this is an American film.
Yeah. And then for the AFI Life Achievement Program, I did a DSA in that as well on him. But it was great fun. It was great fun talking with him. Talked about everything.
And I'm sure that his recall and it's.
He was great.
Yeah. I can imagine.
And it was really a fun week because it was every day. It was like, okay, time to call Kirk. You know, as luck would have it, only about 3 years later, the San Sebastian Film Festival was honoring Wellman. They republished my book on Wellman, and my wife and I were flown over for that. And that's in the Pyrenees, or next, almost in the Pyrenees. So I got there sooner or later.
You did get to the Pyrenees.
Yeah, I just didn't get to meet Kirk Douglas there.
And after all, that was before cell phone. You could have been in a phone booth.
Yes, I could have been. And wouldn't that have been ridiculous?
Yes.
Well, I will...
Hey, it's been great.
It has been so much fun. Thank you so much. And
it's my pleasure.
And by George, I'll be back again. I will.
By George?
Yes. With George. George and I, and I'll be sitting by him, and we'll talk with you again. So, thanks, Rudy.
Hey, you're quite welcome. It was a great pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Rudy Belmer half as much as I enjoyed doing it. And I'm looking forward to a third interview with him in the not-too-distant future. As a matter of fact, I think I should have Rudy on about every 3 weeks. That's what I feel about it. I think that's what would make the commentary track the greatest podcast of them all. Just a constant stream of Rudy Belmer. That's what I think. So I hope you enjoyed it, and that you will join us again next week. I want to give my thank yous first to Claire McCullough Thompson, my wonderful wife, and even more wonderful, I should probably say that vice versa, shouldn't I? She's my wonderful announcer and even more wonderful wife. I nearly put my foot in it that time. I want to thank James Hutchins, who designed my website, thecommentarytrack.com, and also my personal website, frankthompson.tv. I hope you'll visit both of them. I do have one thing that I'm marketing right now, which is a poster from my documentary, The Lost Remake of Beaugest, which every week I think I'm almost finished with it, and this week I think I'm almost finished with it. So from my lips to Allah's ear, let's hope that this thing is almost in the can. But in the meantime, I have a beautiful poster designed by Nick Newton, who's a poster designer par excellence, and I'm selling it for the pittance of $10. And that includes postage. You don't even have to pay postage. I even bought the little mailing tube. This is more than a bargain. This is almost insanity on my part. So on either one of my websites, you can see the poster, and you can order a copy from me, and I hope you will. You can also order my books and videos. If I have books in stock, you can just click on the PayPal, and I will autograph them if you like. And if I don't have books in stock, and I don't have any of the videos, I don't sell any of those myself, but I have provided Amazon links. And if you go through Amazon to buy any of that wonderful stuff, then I get a little kickback from Amazon. And with any luck, tens of thousands of you will buy things from Amazon. And soon I'll be king of the world. I'll be the eighth wonder of the world all over again. A king and a god in the civilization that I know. Please do that. Also, for every one of my guests, including Mr. Rudy Belmer, I have a personal page on the Commentary Track website, and you can go there and see the books and videos that they're involved in, and you can do the Amazon links and get their wonderful stuff. It won't cost you an extra penny, not one extra penny, to go through Amazon that way, and yet I will get a little bit of a kickback. That's win-win, the way I look at it. Also want to thank Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for writing my wonderful theme music. And I also want to alert you that I have a bonus commentary track coming up. A friend of mine, Bob Wade, who is a terrific author and who I met because he was the co-writer, co-director, co-editor, co-star of the parody of Beaugest from 1939, about which my documentary, The Lost Remake of Beaugest, is made. So he passed away a couple of weeks ago, and although I was not surprised by this, the last time I saw him, he was looking pretty frail, and we knew that the time was short, but still, even though it was not unexpected, it's still sad in the extreme. And I wanted to devote a few minutes to talk about him and his remarkable career and how much he meant to me in the 3 years that I knew him. And it's not really a full-length commentary track. It'd be much shorter. I'm putting it up as a little bit of a bonus, but I hope that you will look for that and download it as well. So in the meantime, thanks very much for listening. Please tell your friends to listen. Please pass the word. I need listeners. And please go to iTunes. Leave a good rating. Leave a good review if you're so inclined. But the 5-star ratings are very helpful. And the higher I rank in the iTunes hierarchy, I actually said hierarchy, but it came out in kind of a tone that only dogs could hear. In the iTunes hierarchy, the higher I get up there, the more people will be exposed to the podcast, and the more listeners I get, the better it is for me. So I hope you'll help me out with that. We have some great, great, great guests coming up. So there's a very bright future for this podcast, and I just hope that you'll keep listening and you'll get everyone you know to start listening, and soon all the world will be listening. And then my power will be unchecked. We'll see what happens then. We'll just play it by ear. So we'll see you next week. And in the meantime, don't you worry. We'll fix it in post.